This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The Hurt Locker took home the biggest share of the Oscars last night, including Best Picture, and an historic Best Director for Kathryn Bigelow, the first woman to be so recognized. And it won despite complaints from some bomb disposal technicians that the movie, praised for its gritty authenticity, got some important things about their jobs wrong. That no real EOD tech would approach a bomb that way, that other members of the team acted more like infantry, to which Megan Daume, columnist for the Los Angeles Times, says, "So? Hollywood always plays fast and loose with reality," she writes. "We're not looking for facts. We're looking for entertainment, and even at the movies, some deeper truth that art reveals." So when was your job featured on the silver screen, and did they get the facts and the metaphors right? 800-989-8255 is our phone number. The email address is talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Later this hour, Congressman John Lewis joins us to talk 45 years after Bloody Sunday, the iconic Civil Rights March. But first, your job in the movies. Joining us now is Megan Daume, columnist for the Los Angeles Times. You can find a link to her piece, The Hurt Locker Reality, on our website at npr.org. Megan Daume is at the studios of Marketplace Productions in Los Angeles. Nice to have you back with us.
Great to be back, Neil.
And Hollywood columnists, they've gotten them all right.
Oh, always. I mean, Carrie Bradshaw, c'est moi. That's absolutely my life. As anyone who is a print journalist knows, you sit around in your $800 Manolos and type out your column.
And so, those three martini lunches.
Enough said.
Yes, indeed.
Oh, at your desk at home, you know, with the dog by your feet.
You argue, interestingly, that the details, though they're important, it's the illusion of the details that is more important.
Yeah, you know, I think what's interesting about this whole debate, and obviously I'm not a bomb disposal technician, and it's kind of amusing that all these film critics who are themselves presumably not bomb disposal technicians on the side have been able to vouch for this film's authenticity as well as any other war film. Most film critics are not war veterans, although I'm sure there are some. You know, there is a fascination with realism, particularly among Americans, I dare say. And I think that in film, at least, you see it manifested in a particular aesthetic way. There are certain visual techniques that signify real. You have the handheld camera, which mm-hmm. gives you this shaky documentary kind of look. And I think that when people see that visual cue, they think, oh, this must be completely real. I'm looking at a documentary, even though it's a fiction film.
And therefore, they sort of translate it differently in their brain.
Yeah, it's a film like The Hurt Locker. I thought it was a terrific film. I thought it deserved to win. I know I'm not, you know, speaking here today as a film critic, but I think what a lot of people responded to was the way it looked and that they were seeing something that sounded authentic. You know, that is a big word with people. And the actors, it almost seemed as if they were improvising. Now, mm-hmm. I'm assuming they weren't. There was a script. It was worked over. But it had a sort of aura about it that seemed real. And I can see why perhaps if, you know, for the military personnel who took issue with what was being portrayed, I'm just guessing here, but I'm wondering if they would have felt quite to the degree that they seem to if it had been like a more conventional, big-budget Hollywood kind of movie.
Well, moving from The Hurt Locker on to other kinds of films, you wrote about how the last season of the wonderful HBO series The Wire was, in fact, your least favorite because much of it centered on a Baltimore newsroom, a newspaper. And well, you know something about newspapers.
Yeah, you know, I had really looked forward to the last season of The Wire because, you know, narcissist that I am, I wanted to see my own field portrayed. And I thought, well, I'm just going to get through the first four seasons and then I'm going to get on to the good stuff. And, you know, my husband, who actually works in a newsroom at a newspaper, and I both sort of sat there and said, you know, we loved the first four seasons. This is not as satisfying to us in a way. And it was because we just kind of couldn't get past the dramatic element of the storyline that forces something rather extreme to happen. you know, the journalist was portrayed as making up stories and making up sources and this kind of thing. And obviously this does go on, but it was kind of overlooked and condoned. And then I think he goes on to win the Pulitzer Prize or something for a story that he's made up. And I think we would all choose to believe that things wouldn't go quite that far. But what was interesting about our experience with watching the last season of The Wire is that we had been perfectly content to pat ourselves on the back for thinking that we knew everything about longshoremen from watching the second season of The Wire, which was about port workers. And I'm sure that people who actually do those jobs would perhaps
might
not
have had some
felt
objections.
That
yeah.
way.
Now,
yeah.
Again, on TV, I remember talking to a friend of mine, a newspaper man, who said, you know, we were talking about this was years ago. He loved WKRP in Cincinnati, being a radio guy. I said, wait a minute. Then I said, I loved Lou Grant. He said, no, it doesn't work like that. Well, anyway, what is the Hollywood depiction of your job? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. Did they get it right? The facts? Or more importantly, did they get to some deeper truth? And let's begin with, this is Paul. Paul with us from Panama City in Florida.
Hey, Mr. Conan. It's good to speak to you.
Good to speak with you, Paul.
I was a sonar tech on board submarines for about 4 years back in the mid part of the 90s. And the movie that did a very good job of portraying submarines and sonar in particular was The Hunt for Red October.
Oh, I remember that well. Yes, indeed. Yeah. The sonar operator is a very important part of the plot line.
Yep. And, you know, they did such a good job because they didn't show anything too technical or specific, but they were able to dramatize the job. You know, we on board submarines, we were actually playing around with the movie ourselves. If anybody remembers the part where there's called a crazy Ivan,
right?
It's not actually something that Russian submarines did, but we would every now and again call the officer of the deck and ask him to conduct the crazy Ivan. We got to have fun with ourselves.
All right, Paul, thanks very much. Well, there's one there where they got it right, that Clancy novel, of course, Hunt for Red October, dramatized in a wonderful movie with the other Jack Ryan. That's a long story. Let's see if we can get some other people in on the conversation. This is an email from Ron in Salt Lake City. Though it's not a job, Hollywood has done a terrible job of portraying mountaineering and rock climbing. They love to sensationalize it to the point of complete suspension of reality. See Cliffhanger or the opening sequence of Mission Impossible 2 as examples. Interestingly, one of the best Hollywood climbing films is an older one, The Eiger Sanction, with Clint Eastwood, an absolute classic. Well, again, if they're dramatizing something you know about, it's almost always that they get something really serious wrong. But that point of reaching for, you know, something about a higher depiction of metaphor, even getting back to The Wire, Meg and Dom, they were, I think, making a point not just about the newspaper business in general and about cutbacks in the newsroom and other things, but nevertheless, that this was part of the same corruption process that they saw elsewhere in the city. And I think we've lost Meg and Dom briefly from Los Angeles. In the meantime, we'll get another caller on the line. Let's go next to, this is Dustin. Dustin with us from Casper, Wyoming.
Hello again, Neil.
Hi, Dustin.
I'm actually fourth generation oil field trash.
Uh-huh.
Out here in the oil and gas fields of Wyoming, my father, my grandfather, great-grandfather, my brother even, have all worked in the industry. And we love the movie Armageddon.
Because it featured oil rigger trash in space.
Yes. Yeah, so but the logistics of how they handle the job itself are laughable.
Well,
but willing suspension of disbelief, you know, we watch it, we enjoy it, we love it because hey, when oil field trash saves the world, oh, it's good for us.
That's always good for you. So next time a meteor, an asteroid comes hurtling towards the planet, we'll know where to turn.
Hopefully.
Thanks very much for the call. Let's go next. This is John. John Withers from Wilmington in Ohio.
Yes, good afternoon.
Afternoon.
It's not quite as an exciting job. Not that I storm chase all that often, but you can go out and look for some particularly nasty storms when the weather is just right in your particular section of the country.
And you are a meteorologist?
Yes, a meteorologist with the National Weather Service. But there was a group of us when Twister first came out that went out and saw it. We were out training in Kansas City, so you had about 10 of us or so laughing, enjoying the movie. It was a very good movie, but the actual portrayal of something like that is a bit laughable.
I suspect that's the flying cow, as I recall.
That's one that sticks in your head. You know what? But that's, you know, what the movies are about. A bit of sensationalism isn't too much to ask for.
Well, John, I don't think they've ever made a movie called Bermuda High, where it just stays sunny and warm for days on end.
No. It's not too much excitement going on there.
John, thanks very much for the phone call.
Thank you.
And I guess that's Megan Dahm is back with us from Los Angeles. And Megan, I think that's to some degree the point. Reality is, often a great deal less exciting than fiction.
Yeah, exactly. I think there's an inherent contradiction with representing the workplace in film and television and even in literature to a certain extent, because for the vast majority of people, going to work is a tedious experience. Drudgery and boredom and repetition are the main elements of the day. And so when you try to capture the workplace in a movie, you've got to really take it to a much, you know, more intense and dramatic level. And I don't think it's an accident, by the way, that shows like The Office on television are so popular, because it's entirely about the drudgery of work. The premise is how boring and inane and degrading in a lot of ways the experience of going to work is. And obviously it's a sitcom. It doesn't pass itself off as realism. But for any of us who've worked in offices, I think we know it can be alarmingly true to life, that show.
A sitcom that passes itself off, interestingly, as a documentary being made about an office.
Yeah. And there again, you know, I think it bears kind of thinking about a lot. This documentary style, it's gone from a genre into itself, in and of itself, to really a style. It's an aesthetic that is used in fictional storytelling, and it kind of signals to the viewer that they're getting a particular kind of thing. And the advent of reality television really taps into that.
James in Kokomo, Indiana writes, workers in the nuclear power industry are typically portrayed as either incompetent or misguided tools of big industry. We always seem to be one mistake away from killing half the local community. That's way off, though I will admit that like Homer Simpson, we do like donuts. These portrayals are not helpful as America debates its energy future. So how is your job portrayed on the silver screen? 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. Stay with us. This is NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Is there anything more irresistible and more frustrating than seeing your job portrayed on screen? That's a question Megan Dahm posted in her column last week, and one that some bomb disposal techs have answered recently with their complaints about the Best Picture winner last night, The Hurt Locker. We're talking about last night's Academy Awards and your job as it's portrayed by Hollywood. So if your job has been seen on the silver screen, did they get the facts or at least the metaphors correct? 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. You can find a link to Megan Dahm's column and share your own stories at our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Megan Dahm is with us. She's a columnist for the Los Angeles Times. They're with us from Los Angeles. But here in Studio 3A to talk about last night's Academy Awards is Linda Holmes. She writes and edits Monkey See, NPR's entertainment and pop culture blog. She live blogged the Oscars last night, and a little bleary-eyed, she joins us here in the studio. Nice to have you with us again.
Thank you very much.
And you wrote on the blog, Oscars can be deadly, stuffy, lame, irrelevant, and pretentious, both haughty and ingratiating at the same time. This time around, though, you think it came off fairly well.
I think it came off fairly well. A lot of that, I think, had to do with who was winning and how some of the winners came off, as opposed to maybe the production of the actual show. But yeah, I mean, I think a lot of the winners were likable and gave nice speeches, and people felt good about a lot of those winners. And a lot of, you know, folks who, even in the case of somebody like Sandra Bullock, who a lot of people disagreed with the award, maybe she was likable. She gave a great speech.
And it was not as if there was the acme of competition. It was a fairly weak field for that particular award this year.
I think there were some very good performances in that category, but I don't know that there was one particular one that people thought was overwhelmingly, you know, the favorite. They were sort of all good, so.
Have they shortened the speeches? I mean, it seemed that unless you were getting Best Picture or Best Actor or Best Actress, you got about 5 seconds.
It's really hard to tell. They vary. it seems like some were shorter and some weren't shorter. And they had this plan this year where they were going to have this thank you cam set up backstage so that you could go and thank your agent and your lawyer for the internet-only audience. And perhaps the TV audience would be spared. And I think maybe it helped a little bit. They wanted the acceptance speeches to focus a little bit more on substance of what the award meant to you. It helped a little, but I don't know that it changed the scope that much.
And shorter with the songs, longer on, well, there were 10 nominees. We had to have 10 presentations for Best Picture.
Right. They had to introduce all they do, you know, the little presentations of each of the 10 Best Picture nominees. And they did cut this year the performances of original song, which have, you know, traditionally been included. Some good performances, some disastrous performances, depending on the year. So, but they the more nominees, the more of those presentations you sit through for sure.
And I have to say, I was on a plane for much of the broadcast. One of those planes that does not get television programming.
Sure.
So, how were Steve Martin and Alec Baldwin?
I thought Steve Martin and Alec Baldwin were pretty good. It's really a death slot in a lot of ways. It's an extremely difficult job, and almost nobody ever comes off fantastically well. Steve Martin has done it before, and I think is a really good host. And I think, for the most part, their jokes were, I would say, better than average. They sort of vanished. They weren't on the later parts of the show all that much. But I think the parts that they did were perfectly good, but judging on a curve.
Okay. You know? And finally, the big surprise, not that much of a surprise. A lot of people expected The Hurt Locker to win.
Yeah. None of the really big awards, I think, were surprises. I think that most of the sort of handicappers I had been following had it pretty much down to The Hurt Locker and Avatar, maybe, although Avatar felt like it was losing some steam late in the game. Hurt Locker had picked up a couple of big Guild Awards and things like that, that tend to be signs of what's to come. So I think by the time that happened, The Hurt Locker was probably the odds on favorite. I don't think there were any big surprises among any of the major winners, as a matter of fact.
We should note, those of us who were following the coverage of the best documentary features, we had interviews about all of them. The winner last night was The Cove, and that got a big round of applause, though again, no chance for the political presentation. Somebody held up a sign and they cut away very quickly.
It was a short presentation, yeah.
Yeah, interesting. Thanks very much for being with us, Linda.
Oh, thank you.
Linda Holmes writes and edits Monkey See, NPR's entertainment and pop culture blog. She live blogged the Academy Awards last night and joined us here in Studio 3A. Megan Dom is still with us from our Marketplace Studios in Los Angeles. We're still talking about how your job is portrayed on the silver screen. And let's get back to the calls. This is John. John with us from Los Angeles as well.
Good afternoon. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
I actually work for the United States Secret Service Code Office in Los Angeles, and I must say our job is one of the most overhyped on the silver screen I've ever seen.
We're having trouble with your phone. You work for the Secret Service?
Yes, the United States Secret Service, our field office in Los Angeles.
And it's less exciting than the Clint Eastwood version?
Oh, yes. All of his movies is always running after the bad guy, drawing your gun, taking the bullet, where day-to-day operations, very few people protect dignitaries or protectees. Most of us just investigate every day. It's rather, I love my job, but it's rather boring.
Well, I like the Clint Eastwood movies, but John, I'm glad to know that your job is really boring.
You have a great day.
Okay, bye-bye. Megan, there are some times when you're reassured to find out that somebody's job is duller than you think.
Oh, yeah. It's like, you know, going to visit somebody and realizing that you would never want their life. So, you know, that's a kind of vacation that's worth the price of airfare. You know what I would like to hear from our architects? Because this has always been a pet peeve of mine in movies and maybe even especially on television. If they want to have usually a male character and show that he's creative and he has a sort of design sensibility, but is also manly and masculine and can, like, do math and can wear a hard hat and go up on construction sites, they always make him an architect. And it drives me crazy because not only do these people always seem to have, you know, they're working on, like, their pet projects. They're never doing really boring, like, you know, corporate commissions. They seem to make a lot of money and wear great clothes and live in great houses. And most of the architects that I know could never afford to live in the homes that they design or would like to design. So I'd be very curious. I mean, everyone from the dad on the Brady Bunch to, you know, any number of you know, primetime dramas and any number of movies, they're always architects, and it must drive them crazy.
Amanda in St. Louis wrote to us, as a child of the 80s, I grew up watching Indiana Jones. I can honestly say his adventures didn't inspire me to become an archaeologist. That I can attribute to an incredible gifted program in elementary school. I was, however, definitely inspired by Dr. Jones' ability to speak about 50 languages and blend into any culture. I'm only up to about 8 languages. What I never saw him do, though, was lab work or journal publication. You just don't go out into the field, pull out the shovel until you find something nifty and call it a day. So much of archaeological analysis is based on quantification and analysis of all the small things to create a larger picture. Silly Hollywood. I'm not sure sifting through all that those clay shards would make for much of a movie.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see if we can get another caller on the line. This is Katie. Katie with us from Portland.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Go ahead, please.
Hi. I am a labor and delivery nurse here in Portland, Oregon, and it is painful for me to watch any birth scene on TV or in any fictional movie or anything like that. Not only do they always make the birth just so different than how it is true to life, but the nurse is either cast in the role of like a nurse ratchet who the patient yells at because the nurse is screaming at the patient, or is just standing there looking down, doing nothing, or is mopping the doctor's brow. And in fact, we work very hard. We are never just standing still. It's one of the hardest jobs. In nursing, and it is just so painful to watch it on the big screen.
I suspect. Have you ever actually heard the word clear?
The word clear?
Yes.
You know, although I do have to be certified to be able to use the machine where you do say clear, I have never actually used it.
Well, good.
Or stat. Stat, I'll say.
Stat. No, we do a lot of stat stuff.
Do a lot of stat stuff. That's on the paging system.
True, although I'm not paging. But no, always in the movie, there's the patient like screaming at the nurse, at her husband, "You did this to me!" And I've never heard anybody say that. And then the nurse is often screaming at the patient. And I believe I would lose my job if I started yelling at the patients who I am there to be an advocate for.
Well, I think, like Nurse Jackie, you want to go and chop up a few OxyContins and do those in the bathroom.
I'm afraid I'm a bit frugal and do not even have cable, so I do not watch that show. And I'm sure it would also be painful to watch. What is she doing? Oh, my gosh.
Katie, thanks very much for the call. We appreciate it.
All right. Bye-bye.
Thanks
for having me. Bye-bye.
Email this from E. Sundevil. Teaching high school is a whole lot more like Glee than Stand and Deliver. Well, that's interesting.
Hmm.
Last night, like every other Oscar night, the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences handed out separate awards for Best Actor and Best Actress, and of course, Best Supporting Actor and Actress. In a piece for the New York Times, Kim Elsesser wonders why we still segregate nominations for actors by sex. Is it time for the Academy to change course? And she joins us now by phone. Kim Elsesser is a research scholar at the University at the Center for the Study of Women at UCLA. Nice to have you with us today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And you note correctly, I think, in your piece that the Academy Awards is just about the only time we ever hear the word actress anymore.
Yeah, I'm just like, you don't hear the term stewardess anymore. Everybody calls them flight attendants. You don't hear the term actress anymore. Actresses prefer to be called actors at this point because they do the same exact job as male actors, so there's no reason to have a separate term.
And no separate category for directress. Also, as you point out, Catherine Bigelow, of course, won last night for Best Director, the first time that's happened. I think just the 5th nomination for a woman. And I guess if there were separate categories, a lot more women would have been recognized.
Yeah, no, that is one argument for having separate categories for women. But, I mean, certainly there's no point now in the actor category to have separate categories. There are plenty of great actor roles for female actresses, and there's no need anymore to have separate categories.
I wonder, have you heard any actors or actresses, for that matter, complaining about this?
No, and actually, it's not as much I'm concerned about the actors and actresses. I think the Academy Awards show has about 40 million viewers, and I think it's the message that it sends out to the rest of the world that, you know, that men and women, the differences between men and women are so great that they can't even compete together for the same award.
You really think it sends that message?
I think it does, yeah. And it just perpetuates the stereotypes that, you know, men and women are very different and they can't compete together for the same award, yeah.
It's been pointed out that, of course, Linda Hunt won a Best Supporting Actress award for playing a man.
Exactly. I mean, there's, you know, Hilary Swank won for $1 Million Baby. And, I mean, there's other examples. Julie Andrews and Victor Victoria, Dustin Hoffman and Tootsie. You know, it's not clear that the roles are so different for men and women anymore.
Megan?
Can I jump in and ask a question?
Go ahead.
I just, you know, this isn't something that I've thought a whole lot about, but it occurs to me in listening to this, the conventional wisdom, I think, among you know, certain people in the industry, especially writers and actors, is that there just aren't very many really meaty roles for women. You always hear about these actresses having a hard time, especially if they're older than 40 or something like that, finding decent, well-written, substantive roles. And I wonder if there was only one category, if men and women were competing against each other, if men would end up winning more just because their parts are better written and there's a wider age range in which they can, you know, get a leading role. I mean, I understand from a sort of feminist perspective that it's counterintuitive to have the categories be distinct. But for practical purposes, I wonder if this is a utopian concept.
An intermediate step that they could take, if people are concerned about, you know, we'd never see any women anymore in the awards programs if we eliminated these categories, would be to add an extra category for the best overall performance. So we would have a Bridges versus Bullock contest.
Ah.
And it would have, you know, the added benefit of adding more drama and suspense to the production. And it would certainly be a step in the right direction because it would send the message that, okay, you know, these people aren't so different. They can compete together for the same roles. And
or you argue, do it the way the Globes do, best dramatic role and best role in a comedy or musical.
Yeah, I think that makes more sense.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, all right. Thanks very much for your time, Kim Elsesser.
Okay, thank you.
Kim Elsesser, research scholar at UCLA Center for the Study of Women. Her piece, "And the General Neutral Oscar Goes To," was published in the New York Times. There's a link to it on our website. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And I just want to get to this flood of emails we've gotten about portrayals of jobs on the silver screen. This from Chelsea in San Francisco. As a mother of two, I say nothing ruins a movie for me more than a childbirth scene. There's always the sudden breaking of the water followed by the mad dash to the hospital just in time for the baby to be pushed out. This is so far from typical labor, which is rarely so quick. Let's see if we go next to David. David with us from Jamaica Plain in Massachusetts.
Hey, Neil.
Hi there.
My pet peeve is on photography. I'm a photographer. I've been a photographer for many years, and nobody ever portrays it properly in the movies.
None of them?
They don't get it right. Most of them don't know how to hold a camera. And if they ever get into the old school thing of going in the dark room, everything's always topsy-turvy, upside down and backwards.
Oh, well, I'm sorry to hear that.
The only movie that I saw that is even reasonably good was a movie, I forget the name of it, but it was Nick Nolte, Joanna Cassidy, about Nicaragua, when Nick Nolte was a war photographer.
Yeah. All right. Thanks very much for the call, David. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye. Let's get one more caller in. This is Will with us from Portland, Oregon.
Hi, Neil. I was an expat in Japan for 2 years, and I have to tell you, not long after I came home, Lost in Translation came out. And there's a great scene where Bill Murray is having direction translated to him as he's shooting a commercial.
A whiskey ad, yes.
Yeah, yeah. And I think anybody that has lived in Japan can identify not only with the feeling he was having, but what the translator was going through. Because in a theater of silent people, including my poor wife who doesn't speak Japanese, I was the only one laughing, and I was laughing so hard, half the theater was turning around and looking at me going, "What's he saying? What's he saying?" So
a film that got both the details and the metaphor right. That's a wonderful picture.
Oh, my gosh, yes, so much so.
Thanks very much, Will. Appreciate it. And getting back to your point, Megan Dom, it is not necessarily getting the details right, but getting that larger, thing, I guess we call it art.
Yeah, and that's a really hard thing to pin down. It's ironic that this enormous genre we now know as, quote, reality entertainment is actually about the farthest thing from it. I mean, some of the, you know, obviously I know we're not talking about television, we're talking about movies today, but I don't think it's at all incidental that we are totally barraged with products, mostly on television, sometimes in the movies, that are quote-unquote unscripted, that have people who are not actors, even though many of them are people who are trying to get in or get back in show business. But that's another
story
subject
for another day.
But I mean, but we have, we're being told that we're looking at reality, and that actually looks more fake, more phony than the fictional products that have a documentary tone. So everything's kind of gotten reversed. It's interesting, yet confusing.
Megan Dom helping us out with both the confusion and the interest there in Los Angeles. We thank her for her time, as always. Nice to talk to you again.
My pleasure. Thanks, Neil.
Megan Dom is a columnist for the Los Angeles Times. Coming up next on Talk of the Nation, we're going to be talking with Congressman John Lewis about that day on the Edmund Pettus Bridge 45 years ago. Bloody Sunday. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.